is ready to hear oral arguments in the combined causes of Fitch versus 14th Court of Appeals and Benson versus 14th Court of Appeals. Relators and respondent each have 15 minutes. The court is ready to hear arguments from relators.
May it please the court, Mr. David Webb has been arguing for relators. Mr. Webb has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'd like to convey to you the regrets of Mike Charlton, who represents Bonnie Fitch, the real party in interest, and also a petitioner in this case. Due to illness, he cannot be here today, and he asked me to carry the argument for both. There is no significant difference in our positions. His client is the candidate. My client is the political party who placed that candidate on the ballot. Beginning in 1986, I first appeared before this court on a petition contest matter. In 1990, I appeared before this court on two such matters, which immediately followed the court's decision in the Brady case. This matter, however, which purports to contest the petition, can be decided by this court as a matter of law.
So this is not, in your opinion, a Brady-type situation?
I'd like to analyze it for the court both ways, and I have briefed it both ways. The reason I say I believe it's a matter of law is, number one, the opinion of the 14th Court of Appeals in the Bacon case, which was similar insofar as the issue was raised as to whether the candidate of Mr. Sokolow had properly identified the judicial district court for which he was running. The Bacon court concluded that it should read his application together with his petitions, and in so doing, it found that there had been proper identification of the court for which he had run. If that is done in this case, the application of Bonnie Fitch applies for a place on the Democratic Party 1992 general primary ballot. And from prior appearance, I know the rule is that we can provide one set of voluminous exhibits, and I hope you've received these. I provided 13 sets because I wanted you to see, and I'll get to the constitutional issues later.
These have been distributed to all members of the court.
Thank you, Chief Justice Phillips. There are approximately 1,500 signatures for Ms. Fitch's candidacy. No aspect of those signatures has been challenged. Nor is this an ineligibility case. This is a case over questioning the form, content, or substance of the application or petitions of a candidate. In this case, the petition. In this case, the failure to put in the proper blank that she was to be a candidate for the Democratic primary. Let me tell you something in terms of the fact of that, and then I'll get back to the law. One mistake was made, and this is how. Mrs. Fitch, admittedly, did not carefully read the petition she'd assigned her secretary to type after telling her what to do. Instead of saying Democratic in that blank that's mandated by Election Code 172.027, it says March 1992. That is why we say, for the Bacon case, reading the petition with the application, see, as a matter of law for the Bacon case, that she has complied. But that one mistake on the master petition got photocopied. I know all of you gentlemen know a lot, and I'm assuming much of it personal, about getting petitions together and the laborious and technical duties that is personally as well as in your service reviewing cases like these. That one error magnified and is affecting the desires of expressed in petitions of 1,500 voters. But back to whether or not this case can be decided as a matter of law. In addition to the 14th Court of Appeals Bacon opinion stating that the application and petition should be read together, Section 141.032C of the Election Code states, and I quote, if an application is accompanied by a petition, the petition is considered part of the application, and the review shall be completed as soon as practicable after the date the application is received by the authority. Unquote. The plain words of the Election Code consider the application, which says Democratic primary, and the several hundred petitions, which do not, as one document. We say, on that second point of law, this case can be decided as a matter of law. Thirdly, there are the constitutional issues, which this court has addressed, both, of course, in state constitutional matters, as well as taking into account the federal constitution. In the Brady case, one of the holdings was that statutes are to be given a construction consistent with constitutional requirements when possible. Given that the First Amendment freedom of association rights of, in this case, approximately 1,500 petitioners, but regardless of that, whether or not it had been the minimum of 750 petitioners and no more, as is required to run without a fee for judicial office in Harris County, Texas, had it been 750, I think the burden would be no less to consider the association of those voters to symbolically, through a candidate, express their wishes to participate in the political process. As this court knows, the constitutional doctrines are replete with references to the fact that you've got to be able to cast an effective vote. To cast an effective vote, you have to have access to the political process. To have access to the political process, it cannot be overly technical. I would say respondent's interpretation is the narrowest. Respondent would have the candidate pass through the eye of a needle so narrow that only the most perfect would emerge to face the electorate.
It seemed like Ms. Fitch would have known by now what's required because she's been here before on these type of matters.
You're absolutely right, Justice Gonzalez, and she was profoundly embarrassed to me personally. I can state that unequivocally. She has been here before. She has been here on one of the cases that I referred to in 1990. Now, that was a case having to do questioning the same types of things that Brady questioned. And for the same reasons, this court wrote that the Brady holding would apply and there were fact issues that simply needed to be litigated and had not started in the trial court. Interestingly, this year, after the Brady case, I predicted and later owned up in a letter to the Secretary of State about how wrong I was, that this sort of litigation would substantially drop off. In Harris County, we had more than ever this year. We had 7 cases on our side. This is the only one that was brought as a mandamus. We completed 1 jury trial. We completed 2 final order or opinion of the trial court, all cases except one, which is still pending. That's the case of Judge Eugene Chambers seeking to have his opponent, Elliot Klein, removed from the Democratic Party ballot. This litigation apparently is not going away, but this court has continually worked on it, and I would submit with a challenge like is before us today, the court has the opportunity to state in line and follow precedent in line with the Bacon case from the 14th Court of Appeals, with Election Code Section 141.032C, the plain wording of which considers the application and petitions as one, that this particular type of challenge, just like some of the challenges of the past, saying if there's not a zip code, city's not enough, if there's not a city, zip code's not enough, that those will be a thing of the past.
Do you see a difference between cases that involve a petition and therefore some evidence that someone wants this person to run and cases not involving a petition but merely involving compliance with the election code where this court, to the extent a trend can be ascertained, I think has been rather technical in its requirements. The McCorkle case, the State Democratic Executive Committee versus Raines involving Hurdle trying on the ballot in Amarillo, and they were one executive committee member short of having a live quorum. McCorkle, of course, was taking a dependent clause in one section of four clauses separated by semicolon and applying that to one of the other independent clauses. Is there a difference? Are these two lines, or can this be squared?
I'm not sure I can answer the question as I understood you to pose it, but
well,
in terms of the case,
do we have a separate body of law on petitions? Is there a principal reason for that?
No. I think we clearly have a separate body of law on ineligibility. The McCorkle case was an ineligibility case. I do not recall the facts of the Pirtle case. Sears versus Paiute was an ineligibility case. The Dawkins case recently decided by this court was an ineligibility case. But yes, in petition cases, I do believe you have a different standard. I alluded to one of the threads of that quoted by the Brady opinion. Statutes are given a construction consistent with constitutional requirements. The Brady court went on to cite the Celebrezzi and Tazjian cases from federal law, saying that when political party questions the constitutionality of state statutes regulating the method of seeking a candidate, the courts must apply balancing tests. The court, of course, is familiar with that. I need not belabor it. I think there is a fundamental difference. I've alluded to it before.
But a petition is part of eligibility.
Petition
the same as an A. I mean, you've got to be 35 to run for this court. You've got to have a valid petition to run for that court.
I think it would be wonderful if this court would clarify the uses of the term eligibility and ineligibility. I understand ineligibility to be those matters defined specifically in the election code, and may be able to find that before I come back. Other matters, and clearly this matter, is a matter of form, content, or procedure governed separately by the code, always dealt with in the context of First Amendment rights.
Any other questions?
Yes. You refer to this as an eye of the needle, but it's not a very narrow eye. If you read the statute, it's pretty plain what goes in the blank.
No question about it.
Although it's not plain from the form itself. What if the name had been omitted under similar circumstances? Just an inadvertence.
I think the same result. Given our affidavits that say all the circulators informed all the petitioners, and here's where we get to the fact issue part of this case. There are facts to explain this conduct, to explain this global situation that resulted from one error multiplied 200 times, signed 1,500 times. And for a judge or a jury to weigh and balance those facts, and for a judge or an appellate court to balance per the constitutional standards the harm versus the necessity of the regulation. And I remind you, we don't have political party registration in Texas. The only people forced to register are those who sign petitions, because only they have to choose 3 months before the primary which primary they're going to vote in.
So with respect to the three statutory requirements in the blanks, the name, the title, and the party's name, you would say that they should all be treated equally for purposes of any kind of inadvertent failure.
I'm sorry, I failed to answer your question. As to the political party, I think that the doctrine that the application governs. Now, if it didn't say Democratic Party on her application, I wouldn't be able to argue to you the election code provision I did, 141.032C, or the Bacon case.
But it almost has to say it, wouldn't it? She's got to file it somewhere.
Yes, that's right. And she did file it with the Democratic Party. We have an affidavit of that effect. So had she omitted to, we might have an argument. But I don't want to go out on that limb if I don't have to.
What is the, and finally, what is the purpose, or do you have any argument as to what the purpose is of requiring the political party's name to be stated on the petition form.
I have searched and found none in the literature. I have surmised in the brief that I've filed that it must be to force voters to make a choice as to whether they're Democrats or Republicans early on when they're going to sign somebody's petition. I don't see anything terrible as public policy 3 months plus ahead of the filing deadline, ahead of the primary, when filing has to be done, 3 months and longer, having the same person sign a petition for both a Republican candidate and for a Democratic candidate. That person's brother or sister signing no petition can choose after the end of the campaign whether to vote in the Republican primary or whether to vote in the Democratic primary. But right now, if you sign a petition, you're locked in.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Eugene Clements will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court, the fundamental question here, and I think the court has repeatedly raised it, is what is the difference between this particular requirement and the requirements such as Bacon for state, city, for a comma being here or a semicolon being there? And the answer to that is very simple. The answer is, in four different sections in the election code, the Texas legislature went out of its way not only to require that this precise language appear on the petition, be read to each petition signer, and then be verified by affidavit that it has been read to the petition signer in a way so specific that I think even I read Dawkins, I read Justice Gamage, Justice Mozzie's dissent, you'd have to say the legislature has spoken clearly and unequivocally that these things must be communicated. Why? Because when a petition signer signs, they are opting, not Democrat or Republican, they are opting one party versus all others. They can't vote Rosa Unita, they can't vote Socialist Workers, they can't vote Libertarian. If you sign Ms. Fitch's petition, not knowing she's a Democrat, you are precluded from voting, participating in constitutional convention, participating in primary elections of any, quote, other party than the March 1992 party. The importance of this section is that it doesn't just impact the candidate as it would if the name were omitted. It doesn't just impact the candidate as if it were the office that is omitted. It impacts every signer of the petition. Mr. Webb professes mystification as to where this came from. I don't think he's so mystified. Every member of this court can, without scratching his head, remember the days when there were advertisements on television, get two chances to vote conservative, vote in the Democratic primary in May, and come back and vote Republican in November. This is party raiding. If there's a question about what it is, go read the Supreme Court opinion in Rosario versus Rockefeller, where the requirement in New York state law is discussed as at length. The prohibition against party raiding is nothing unique to Texas. It's consistent with every state where there are primaries, where they want to protect the integrity of the primary process.
Let me interrupt for a minute.
Yes, sir.
You think any of those persons that signed Judge Fitch's petition were misled in any way?
Yes. I think they were. They signed a document. They didn't have her application. Counsel tells us you can read the application and petition together, and he cites a provision of the election code that says the petition can be read in conjunction with the application, but it doesn't say the reverse. It doesn't say that the petition is read and incorporates the application. Why? Because the voters don't see her application. They are told only what the legislature, or they should be told, only what the legislature requires them under penalty of law, under section 141.026, be read to them.
What party do you think that these people thought she was running under?
They probably thought she was running under the Democratic Party, but the effect, Your Honor, technically speaking, strict construction, would suggest that these people, these 1,500 people, are prohibited even from participating in the Democratic Party primary because her petition didn't comply with strict state law, and therefore the public policy of this state says they couldn't even go to the Democratic convention after they voted or didn't vote in the Democratic primary. They were entitled to go to only one party convention, and it was the March 1992 party.
If the affidavit at the bottom is true, though we must assume that it is, the affiant says, I called each signer's attention to the above statements and read them to him before the signer affixed his signature to the petition. If that's literally true and that statement was read, what is your view of what the signer would understand by the statement that was read to them?
He wouldn't understand. He wouldn't. The voter who signed the petition would not know that he couldn't participate in the Republican, the Raza Unida, the Socialist Workers Party primary or convention, and strictly construed, he couldn't even participate in the Democratic primary.
But what if the affiant said, well, yeah, well, that's... But telling you this is a Democratic candidate.
Well, that's exactly what the affiant said in the affidavits attached to petitioners, to relator's petition, except that they didn't comply with the statute. If you read the form affidavits, which are attached as exhibits to Ms. Fitch's petition for writ of mandamus, they don't comply with the statute either. They are not substantial compliance because they don't warrant, A, you can't participate in the constitutional in the convention of the party, and they don't say that while you have to vote in the Democratic Party, you are prohibited from voting in any other party's primary, much less the convention.
I haven't looked at all at every page on here. Are there any of these where the March 1992 was scratched out?
None. They were all wrong. And, you know, it was a very...
Secondly, we're not dealing now with total hypothetical. The court has not treated this as an emergency because both of these primaries were unopposed.
Yeah.
Have you looked, or has anyone had the opportunity to look back at the voting rolls of the March 10th primary and see where these 1,500 signers voted, if at all?
No, we have not, Your Honor. I don't
that
know
that information is or soon will be available.
Well, technically, they shouldn't have been voting in either party primary, or in any party primary if there was a third party available to them. Secondly, with respect to the constitutional challenge, we don't think this is a Brady case at all. There is no First or 14th Amendment question here. There is no burden that has been borne by the voters. If anything, the voters who signed Ms. Fitch's petitions have been damaged by having done so in ways that this court can't correct. They have violated state law. And by the way, we came across a Attorney General's opinion subsequent to filing the brief. It's opinion number MW175, handed down May 1, 1980 by Attorney General Mark White, in which he says the public policy of the state is incorporated in the requirement that parties who sign the petition be advised that the candidate of one party and may not that the candidate is of one party and they may not participate in the primary and party affairs of other parties. We're not dealing here with a Bacon case where, first place, two of the judges who decided this case sat on the Bacon panel and participated in the Bacon decision. That was a case of strict compliance because the petition forms didn't have a blank for Texas, and there was no requirement that Judge, 313th District Court, be there. 313th District Court was not substantial compliance. It was strict compliance with the election code. The Bacon case, secondarily, did not involve a situation which went to the rights or interests of any third parties, as this does, and where the legislature has so clearly manifested its concern. I know of no other situation in all of our law where the legislature has written the precise language which a voter must see before signing the petition and which appears again on the ballot in the primary, and then requires not only that the language be used word for word, but it must be printed on the petition, it must be read, and then a responsible person has to sign an affidavit that they read that language, not that they gave some reasonable facsimile of the language that came close. The exact language was what the legislature required, and it did it for a good reason. And Mark White told us what it was. It's the public policy of the state to protect the integrity of the primary system. We don't want one party raiding the other. We don't know whether that happened in this case, Chief Justice Phillips, but it's irrelevant whether it did or not. The legislature enacted these prohibitions so that we wouldn't have to go back and make that kind of factual inquiry. It is truly irrelevant whether these voters were told something close to what the legislature said they were required to have read to them.
Well, in fact, of course, Ms. Fitch has repeatedly been a candidate on the Democratic ballot.
She has.
If every one of these voters voted in the Democratic primary or didn't vote at all, we really are. We're talking about a situation in this particular case of no harm. Now, there may be a systemic harm here. There may be very good reasons for this. There are very good reasons, I think, for this requirement that this be read. But on these, in this particular situation, I wonder if there's any harm. And I'm not saying that's dispositive.
Do you want to open that can of worms? We got one area where strict compliance has not only been mandated by case after case after case, but where the public policy of the estate and the legislature have spoken clearly and definitively. This is not a situation where you need to stretch to cure a problem that is hurting the political process. This is a case where a candidate, for the second time, as Justice Gonzalez points out, has screwed up.
Is an individual who signs the petition for a candidate in one party and then votes in the primary of another subject to criminal penalties?
No, he violates the law, but there's no criminal penalty. That's section 141.026 of the election code. It is prohibited, but there is no penalty that attaches to it,
so
no fine.
The public policy of the state is one way, but there's no means for enforcing that public policy.
Except prohibit them. Theoretically, the voters' vote in the primary should not be counted if somebody did their homework, found that they had signed a petition of a candidate of the other party. Their vote should not be counted. They shouldn't be permitted to vote. But there is no fine or criminal.
So you're saying there could be a challenge by the election
yes.
judge at the
oh, yeah.
time of the vote?
And there could be a challenge, particularly at the convention that night. What happened back in the old days was large numbers of people would show up at a party convention and supporting a candidate that they found more to their philosophical liking. And, of course, when November rolled around, they had no intention of supporting that candidate. They were going to support the other party's candidate. And that's what these provisions were designed to prevent. And they went to the petition signers because they were the people most keenly involved in the political process and most likely to engage in party raiding, which is exactly what the state's trying to prevent.
If the application is denied in this case by this court, what is your understanding of the effect of that on the electoral process in this race?
If the application is denied and the stay lifted, the 14th court writ of mandamus is effective. It is only stayed by this court, and my understanding is that Mr. Benson will then withdraw the certification to the county chairman. That's what the county chairman's filing yesterday or the day before in response to the mandamus action against her indicated she would do.
And then?
And then Ms. Fitch will not be on the ballot as a candidate of the Democratic Party.
And then?
And presumably Ms. O'Neill will be elected because there will be no other candidate running.
There's no opportunity to replace a candidate.
There is no opportunity. The provisions that govern in the event of the death of the candidate during the period between primary election and the general election or the move or withdrawal of a candidate simply don't apply when the candidate has been declared ineligible, as indeed the 14th Court did before the primary. We think there's been no waiver and no valid claim that could be made that Ms. O'Neill has rested on her rights.
With regards,
With regards to the relief granted by the Court of Appeals, isn't all that moot now because if Chairman Benson has certified the application and the petition and has submitted it to the county chairman and the Secretary of State, and it's out of his hands?
No.
What power does Chairman Benson have at this point to do anything? Well, it seems to me like it'd be the Secretary of State or somebody else to get, should be ordered, if it's going to be in order at all, to remove a person from the ballot. He is powerless to do anything.
I don't think it was necessary, but out of an abundance of caution, we filed a second mandamus against Ms. Roadheaver last week and requested that Ms. Fitch's name be removed from the general election ballot on the off chance that this court should conclude that the prior relief sought has now become moot. I don't think it is moot because the fundamental power to determine who the candidate of the party will be resides with the county chair. As of last Wednesday, Mr. Benson had not certified to the Secretary of State who the candidates of the party will be. I don't know whether he's done that yet. He has until April 2. So if this court acts promptly, clearly Mr. Benson has the authority through April 2 to certify or to withdraw certification of a candidate who has failed of fulfilling the qualifications to run, as Ms. Fitch, we feel, plainly has.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Go ahead, Mr. Thomas.
You have 3 minutes, I believe.
Okay.
Yes. Clearly, the opposition would exalt strict construction over all. But this court and Brady and many other decisions affecting ballot access has followed the several doctrines of the United States Supreme Court in the Celebrezze case and the Tasgene case, implying what amounts to a balancing test. As articulated from the four-part test in Tasgene, the test stated in Celebrezze, of course, fashioned its own test in Brady. If you do not believe that this case should be decided in petitioner's favor, the later's favor as a matter of law, I urge that under Brady you send it to a trial court.
Would the factual issue in Brady, in this case, as in Brady, be whether or not each of the people filing the affidavit, when they got to the word March 1992, inserted the word Democratic as they were reading, but saw no need to make a mark on the paper?
I think so.
Now, how many signatures? Was Ms. Fitch running on the pay some money and get some signatures, or on the signatures only?
Solely signatures.
And how many were required?
750.
And she got 750 extras?
Yes.
So the test, if we were to remand, would be to find that at least 750 people were told the word Democratic, heard the word Democratic, and thereby fixed their signature.
I believe that would be the test. And again, it would be a fact question for a trier of fact, whether judge or jury, and then the application, nevertheless, I think, of the constitutional standards. In other words, this case came back up again before the 14th court or the 1st or this court. I would think, nevertheless, there's a balancing to be done as a matter of law because of the doctrines that I've just cited. She's not ineligible because she's too young, because she's been convicted of a felony. Her petition has a defect. The question is how you balance it.
Now, isn't that the same as whether there's a meeting by telephone or in person of county chairs to nominate a candidate?
I would say it's similar, not knowing how that one came out.
Well, that's right. Come on.
I want to make a point. Opposing counsel He pointed out how in the old days you could vote Democratic in the primary and go to the convention and vote Republican in the fall, if I understood it correctly. Well, you sure still do that. The only people who can't do that are those who sign a Republican's convention. They can't then vote Democratic and vice versa. And that's the only policy I've discerned under this. The harm is it's going to prevent 1,500 people from having expressed their will. Let the people decide.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes oral arguments in this cause. The foregoing cases are all submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
Judge, please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.